In 1996, a 37-year-old pastor named Eric Daniel Harris pled guilty to charges of arson for burning down his own church, the Kentucky Missionary Baptist Church in Saline County, Arkansas. After the trial, a local news reporter asked him curiously, "Pastor, why in the world did you burn down your own church?" Reverend Harris said, "Well, I have to admit that I did it for the sake of Christian unity." "Christian unity?" the reporter responded in a flabbergasted tone. "What on earth do you mean by that?" "Well," Reverend Harris said, "there was a lot of division among my church members, and I thought they needed a project that would bring them together." We live in a nation today that is sharply divided and deeply polarized. When you Google the term "divided America," you get 316 million results. In the last 2 years, news outlets like the Associated Press, PBS, and Epix have all created full-blown documentary series profiling a divided America. Social psychiatrist Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, contends that the differences between Americans today are not simple disagreements on fundamental issues or even a basic dislike for people on the other side. Research shows, he says, that most Americans now believe the other side is a threat to the nation. And they use terms like of contempt and dehumanization to describe the opposition that reveal inner feelings of disgust or revulsion. Over 30% of Democrats and 30% of Republicans believe it is likely that we will have another civil war in their lifetime. We are a divided country. And arising out of our frustration with division, we are now also overwhelmed by a cultural obsession for some kind of unity that could overcome the divisions that exist between us. Calls for unity abound in the public square today, and they appear in many different forms. Some calls for unity are appeals for civility and tolerance or mutual respect in speech and public discourse, courtesy, politeness, and good manners. Other calls for unity are appeals to a common sense of identity or shared values, often rooted in nostalgia of an imagined American past. The ideal of unity has captivated everyone, including our Christian communities. The United Methodists and the Cooperative Baptists are both divided over the issue of LGBTQ inclusivity, and they are struggling to stay together and wrestling with the question, is unity our highest good? Is it more important than freedom? Is it more important than truth or justice or equality or love? How do we weigh the importance of unity? Or better yet, what is unity? What does it look like? How does it happen? What makes true unity possible? The Bible, as you know, affirms the importance of unity. In John 17, Jesus famously prayed for unity among his followers. In addition, the Apostle Paul was concerned about unity in almost all of his letters, especially in this letter to the Ephesians that was written to the churches in the Lycus Valley. Paul said, "Therefore, make every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." But is the unity that Paul called for the same kind of unity that is being called for in America today? Have you ever noticed that after every hotly contested election, the winner and sometimes the loser as well calls for unity? It's not really unity that they are calling for, is it, in those moments? But loyalty. Sometimes even blind loyalty. Unity and loyalty are not the same thing. When the letter to the Ephesians was written, Mediterranean people thought they knew about unity. They looked back to Alexander the Great as the great uniter of the entire world. What kind of unity did Alexander the Great provide? The Roman historian Plutarch stated it quite bluntly. Alexander the Great came as a heaven-sent governor to all, as a mediator of the whole world. Those whom he could not persuade to unite with him, he conquered by force of arms. And he brought together in one body all men everywhere, uniting and mixing in one loving cup their lives, their characters, their marriages, and their very habits of life. Just as Rome brought peace through war, brutality, and oppression, so too Alexander the Great brought unity through violent conquest, force, and coercion. This wasn't really peace or unity at all, but an obligation of loyalty to the empire. The theme of overcoming factionalism and restoring order was a familiar theme of imperial propaganda as it is today. Talk of loyalty under the guise of unity was in the air and on the walls of the Greco-Roman world. And Paul tapped into this cultural obsession with unity and offered an alternative vision, a different kind of unity. The unity of God. The unity, he said, of one new humanity. Many of the calls for unity that we hear in our culture today are not really calls for oneness, but for sameness. If everyone would just speak English, if everyone could just be American first, if everyone would just follow basic Judeo-Christian values, if we could all just agree to be good capitalists, then we would have unity. But that's not unity. That's assimilation. Attempts to unify people through a common language or nationality or identity or ideology or religion or universal currency or one world government are all attempts to create sameness, not oneness. Unity cannot be made through assimilation or tribalism or dogma. Throughout history, the church has made the same mistakes that nation states have made, imagining that unity can come through shared doctrines or agreed upon beliefs. But a unity, that is not the unity that Paul and Jesus call for. The unity that Paul and Jesus called for was not a unity based in our agreements, but a unity based in humility, gentleness, patience, peace, and love. Held together by a sevenfold oneness, one body, one spirit, one hope, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God who is above all and through all and in all. The true unity of God is never the elimination of difference, but the beautiful diversity of people and a variety of gifts held together in oneness and love. Paul's call for unity was not unity for unity's sake. Unity for Paul is the environment that leads to spiritual growth, formation, and maturity. It's not a surprise that immediately after calling for unity, Paul began discussing maturity. He said, "We must no longer be children tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming. But speaking the truth in love," he said, "we must grow up in every way into Christ." There's quite a difference between a childish unity that leads to assimilation, sameness, loyalty to the empire, or the elimination of difference, and the unity that leads to maturity, on the other hand. Childish unity is born from the violence of cultural assimilation. Mature unity is born from the bonds of peace and love. A unity that is based in sameness or agreement means that every difference or dispute calls for division. On the other hand, a unity that is built on love means that we can appreciate each other's differences and disagree with one another without being divided or breaking down the community. The term Paul used in his letters to describe the process of creating unity among different people was the term reconciliation. Reconciliation for Paul developed within the context of relations between Jews and Gentiles living in the Roman Empire. The congregations he built were a mix of colonized persons, the Jews, and those who were the colonizers, the oppressed and the oppressors. When Jews saw Roman soldiers and citizens sitting in their midst in worship, they were reminded of their oppression. When they sat next to Gentiles who benefited from Roman rule, they were painfully aware of their low social status. Every time these communities spoke and sang a song about Jesus being crucified, they were acknowledging the state-sponsored violence of the cross that the Roman Empire used to terrorize and intimidate Jewish people, to stamp out resistance, to quell rebellion. Given the brutality and bigotry that Jews experienced as occupied subjects of the Roman Empire, it is absolutely incredible that any Roman Gentiles were actually invited into these Jewish communities of faith. The word reconciliation in the Greek is katalasso, and it literally means to change or to exchange places with another person. When Romans and Greeks were invited into the communities of Jewish followers of Jesus, they had to change. There was no way around it. They had to replace their loyalty to the empire and to Caesar with loyalty to Christ, to God. Gentile Christians had to defect from their own original entitlements. They didn't have to become Jews per se, but they had to reject the privileges that go with power and position and enter into solidarity with the marginalized and oppressed who'd been colonized by the Roman state. It is obvious throughout the letters of Paul that status inversion of some kind occurred in the first century church as a result of reconciliation and unity between Gentiles and Jews. By joining a minority religious community, Romans and Greeks were being identified with a socially stigmatized people. And then they were united as a family with the very people who were oppressed by the Romans. This had life-altering repercussions for their status in the empire. In the book United by Faith, a team of sociologists argue that the integrated congregations that were founded by Paul produced a movement of social unity across the great divide of culture and tradition and class and race. Ultimately, the unity of this first century church was the result of the miracle of reconciliation, a miraculous conversion from their ethnocentrism to the intention, practice, and vision of Jesus. Paul's strategy for building these communities of reconciliation was always to start by going to the synagogue in each Roman province first, and then by recruiting Jews there who were the ethnic minority and oppressed subjects of the empire. And once a core community of Jewish followers of Jesus was established and bonded, only then did they invite Romans and Greeks from the dominant culture to join in. We often think that inclusivity begins when those on the inside with power welcome the marginalized. But the primary biblical model for building communities of reconciliation is to start with the members of an oppressed minority and let them welcome in people from the dominant culture into the fold. It was the marginalized Jews who created unity by inviting people of power and advantage from the Roman world to come and be reconciled to them. Jewish writer Albert Memmi once said, "In order for a colonizer to depart from oppressor status, they must be adopted by the colonized." In society at the time, Jews were socially beneath the Romans and the Greeks. But inside the church, the Jews were in leadership. Therefore, the Romans and the Greeks, followers of Jesus, had to submit themselves to the direction of Jewish leadership. The privileges and advantages that they had in society were not acknowledged in the church. This was a great reversal of roles. It was the fulfillment of Jesus' promise about the kingdom of God that the last would become the first and the least would become the greatest. The Gentiles had to be adopted by a marginalized people. For these Gentiles to reconcile with Jews and create integrated communities throughout the empire, they had to discard their Roman perspectives and positions of cultural power and replace them with true familial bonds of unity. Reconciliation in the early church meant that people of power in Roman culture actually exchanged places with the oppressed. They had to give something up. It was the only way for there to be equality or unity between the powerful and the powerless. On April 12, 1963, 8 clergy leaders came together and published an open letter entitled A Call for Unity. They were an ecumenical group that included 2 Episcopalian bishops, 2 Methodist bishops, a Catholic bishop, a Presbyterian moderator, a Jewish rabbi, and a Baptist pastor. They wrote a call for unity in response to demonstrations that were taking place in their city. They took issue with protests directed and led by outsiders and urged activists to engage in local negotiation and use courts if rights were being denied. And they ended their letter by saying, "We strongly urge our own black community to withdraw support from these demonstrations and to unite locally in working peacefully for a better Birmingham." The outsider they were referring to, of course, was Martin Luther King, who had been arrested for protesting the day before and who replied to these white clergy leaders with his famous indictment, of white moderates in the letter to the Birmingham jail. The white clergy wanted unity on their own terms. Their call for unity was not really about unity, but about ending protests, silencing demonstrations, maintaining order, and keeping the status quo. They were trying to have unity without justice, reconciliation without change. Today, we become those same white leaders whenever we call for unity without justice or transformation. Reconciliation and unity was not achieved by Romans and Greeks coming to the Jewish people and saying, "What's 500 years of imperial oppression between friends? Let's forget about the cross. Let's forget about the destruction of the temple and the razing of Jerusalem. Can't we all just get along?" Reconciliation only happened when Romans experienced a reversal of their position in culture, a social status inversion by exchanging places with the Jewish people and trading the roles with the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed. Why would any Roman or Greek person be willing to submit themselves to this? Would we? The fact that any Gentile ever joined one of these Jewish communities is a true miracle. A miracle of reconciliation. A powerful and unexplainable spiritual transformation. As scholar Brian Bantam states, the power of reconciliation leads to a place where people can no longer return to their former position, for they speak with a new accent. Their lives are marked by new rhythms. They have been sutured together in a new humanity and are surprised by the people that they have become in the process. Everyone loves to talk about reconciliation and unity, but no one likes to talk about what it will cost. What we're often after is a cheap unity, just like the cheap grace Bonhoeffer cautioned us against. But we can't actually have reconciliation without sacrifice. And we can't have true unity without giving something up. For oppressed people like the Jews, reconciliation required forgiving their Roman Gentile oppressors, which was no small task. For the Romans and Greeks, unity required giving up their power, their social status, and imperial loyalties in order to live in solidarity with the marginalized. Again, this was no small task. It would require taking on the very virtues that Paul commended: humility, gentleness, patience, peace, and love. In the Hellenistic world, humbling oneself was a form of humiliation, self-denigration, servility, unbecoming of self-respecting free persons in Greco-Roman society. And yet, the sacrifice of humility is exactly what was needed of those in power. Humility is the most important virtue required for living in community with those who are different. It is what leads to unity. It is what makes for peace. And it looks like putting ourselves in the shoes of the marginalized, standing in the place of the dispossessed, taking on the cause of the poor, living alongside and possibly even voting in the interest of the oppressed. We live in a world that is desperately in need of reconciliation and unity. But how do we get there from here? In an interview in Time magazine, Brian Stevenson, the author of Just Mercy and founder of the National Memorial for Victims of Lynching in Montgomery, recently said to Time magazine, "I am a proponent of truth and reconciliation. I just think those things are sequential. We need truth first. Only then can there be reconciliation. If there is no truth, there can be no reconciliation. But if we seek truth, then the truth will set us free." We do not need a false unity that is a disguise for loyalty, agreement, assimilation, tolerance, or the eradication of difference. We do not need a false unity based on violence, sameness, quietism, injustice, maintaining order, or the status quo. We do not need any more false, cheap, or childish forms of unity that cost us nothing, make no demands on our lives, and offer the world no change or transformation. What we need is true unity, a mature and costly unity that comes from love, a love that is based in truth, and a truth that is born from love. What we need is the true unity that happens when people give up their power and position in society to live in solidarity with the poor, the marginalized, and the oppressed. What we need is a true unity that appears when we are willing to practice humility, gentleness, patience, peace, and love. That is what creates the true unity of God, which is the only kind of unity that has the power to celebrate our differences, to reconcile our past, to bring us all together, and to make us one. Amen.